From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, here it is June 6th, in some areas of the Wasatch Back, there remains quite a bit of snow still to melt. Our local creeks and streams remain relatively high in flow. So how is that impacting the wastewater collection and treatment infrastructure here in the Park City area?
Well, joining us in the first part of the show to discuss this will be Mike Lewers, the general manager of the Steinerville Basin Water Reclamation District. He'll give us an update on how snowmelt is affecting his treatment plants along East Canyon Creek and Silver Creek.
Then in the second part of the show, we'll speak with Robert Hedges. He's the author of the new book, Wildflowers of Park City.
Wildflowers of Park City is a coffee table book that explores and celebrates the tapestry of wildflowers, scenic trails, plant lore, and even wildlife sightings in the landscapes around and near Park City, Utah.
Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us the first part of the show is Mike Lewers. He is the general manager of the Steinerville Basin Water Reclamation District. And he's here to talk about several things. But first of all, we're probably going to focus on snowmelt and the impacts to the wastewater treatment collection and a collection and treatment system. Mike, thank you for joining us this morning.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for the invite.
As always, thanks for taking the time to come down to the studio and chat with us. We've had a record year of snowfall and arguably a record year for snow melt, let's say, in one form or another. Although that is a conversation in and of itself, how the melt has kind of rolled out, we'll say, these past few months. But you and your treatment plants, we mentioned East Canyon Creek and the one at Silver Creek, wastewater treatment plants, they are impacted in one form or another by snowmelt. So let's give us a little summary about what that impact looks like.
Sure. Well, to start with, the snowmelt this year could not have been better. Record amount of snow in the hills. You know, we anticipated some significant flooding on East Canyon Creek. That did not occur. Certainly the creek was running pretty high and continues to do so, but we do not anticipate any major flooding at this point.
What did you expect?
Well, we saw flows around 300 cubic feet per second, and we were expecting flows greater than 600. So significantly less than what we thought. Certainly the cool nights during the peak runoff really saved the day.
So were you planning for like the plant, East Canyon Creek plant, to be overwhelmed by water?
Well,
at 600 CFS?
At 600 CFS, the water starts impacting the actual footprint of the buildings, and we had thousands of sandbags ready to go. Mm. We had emergency planning in place to deal with it. Again, fortunately, we didn't have to do that, but we did anticipate some significant impacts.
Now, you're upstream, Swanner's upstream. were you looking at the same kind of expectations?
We were, and much like Mike, we expected much higher flows. Some of our listeners or KBCW listeners might know that an old like earth dam broke, and we were expecting that might happen at higher levels, but we've had really pretty mild levels of flow, and we feel super lucky about that.
You're right.
Mike and I certainly have communicated about the flows this spring.
Right. Okay. So that's the first piece of good news, as like I say, how the melt has kind of evolved over time. And now would you say that you're not expertise on this, but would you say that the melt is kind of on the other side of peak?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We're in the last 25% of the snow melt that impacts us. So that's good news. But, you know, you keep in mind that we have two, I'm going to call it, water systems in our area. One's storm water and one's wastewater. So rain, snow melt, and all of those types of precipitations that fall out of the sky end up in our storm water system, and that's not part of our system. Storm water system runs into the nearest creek or stream, and then it's done. The wastewater system is where the sanitary sewage is gathered, and it's a closed system, and it is a system that eventually ends up at one of our two treatment plants. Now, what happens during these snowmelt periods of each year is that there's lots of water running down the road because you have these piles of snow on both sides of the road, and we have these manhole covers out in the middle of the road. We have over 7,000 of them, and while each one may only leak, so to speak, a little bit, we do get quite a bit of clean water into our system, and we can talk about that problem that that causes. And there's certainly a big, big problem with the high groundwater this year, and people are using their sump pumps and installing new sump pumps to take care of the groundwater that's impacting their basements and lower levels of their homes. And that's something we need to talk about, because we do not want sump pumps connected to the wastewater system. They need to be connected to the nearest, I'm going to call it stormwater ditch or pipe, or out in front of your home on the gutter.
I'm glad you brought that up. You kind of made several points we'll probably want to expand upon, but the sump pump is a key one, and it seems like there has been some confusion this spring as people get these new sump pumps installed on the part of both contractors and residents mm-hmm. about where it should be going. People are concerned that it's, you know, pollution if they put it into the stormwater drain, mm-hmm. But it's just kind of groundwater, right? Ambient groundwater that needs to not go through the treatment system.
That's correct. So, you know, if you have high groundwater impacting your basement in your home or your business, and you have a sump pump, that's what we call clean water. It's not polluted, and it should just go into the nearest stormwater or a ditch, or even water your trees in your backyard. But to tie it to the wastewater system, what you're doing is you're overloading our system. And that's where problems really develop. There's kind of two problems associated with clean water getting in our system. And the first is this is too much water. You know, you exceed the hydraulic capacity of our pipes, our pumps, and our tanks. And at the treatment plant, it just overflows onto the ground. Now, fortunately, that didn't happen this year, but we did have some very high flows, and we had to go to some pretty extraordinary operating procedures to prevent problems from occurring, and we can talk about that. And then the second is, you know, wastewater is treated by feeding the billions of living bacteria and little tiny critters that we have at our treatment plant. We feed them with basically what you flush, the organic material. And we think of it kind of like a farming operation, but our cows are really tiny, and they take food to maintain. And when you put clean water in there, you would kind of think that, well, that's a good thing because it's easy to treat. But the problem is there's no food coming in, and our bacteria starve to death. And if you were to starve all of our bacteria, you can actually completely destroy our treatment process.
Wow, so clean water bad for your plant.
Clean water is bad for the plant.
We want the clean water in the stream.
That's right.
Right, running by your place.
And the dirty water,
right.
Yeah.
Keep it there. Okay, so how much clean water were you seeing at its peak?
So at the
percentage or so?
Well, at the peak, we were seeing about 10, a total flow at East Canyon facility, about 10 million gallons a day. Now, keep in mind that facility is only designed to handle 5 million gallons a day.
Wow.
So we had double the capacity. And we calculated about 93% of that flow was clean water getting into the system.
What?
Wow.
Yeah, on
so
a peak.
Primarily through those 7,000
right.
Manhole covers?
And sump pumps. So basically, you know, out of that 10 million, you know, your 8-9 million of it was clean water getting into the system. And I can tell you we had to really work to keep the system operating, and our bacteria were starving, and we were really concerned. So, you know, please, if you have a sump pump, give us a call. We'll come out and inspect it, you know, no cost. And we do have a program where we can assist in paying to disconnect that from the wastewater system. We can pay up to $1,500, And that's something that we've been really working with a number of homeowners. We've had over 200 calls on this. And the problem is, if you have a sump pump, you not only impact the treatment of the wastewater, but if you overload the sewer line in front of your home, then raw sewage can back up into your house. And that's something I can promise you, you don't want to have happen. You know, while it may be expensive and a big deal to disconnect a sump pump in some situations, the last thing you want is raw sewage floating in your living room.
Or it might impact your neighbors.
Neighbors.
Right? Because you're just adding water to a line of pipes that get overwhelmed and back up everybody's.
Yeah, you can back up an entire neighborhood. You can back up a business area.
Okay.
You know, the wastewater lines that we maintain were never designed to receive water from sump pumps. So hydraulically, it's just too much water, and you can back it up into homes, businesses, and that's really something that you want to avoid because you could be held liable for that.
So in addition to doing the right thing for the wastewater system, you also avoid a potentially catastrophic situation in your own home, your neighborhood.
That's correct.
Your neighbor's home. Okay. Yeah. I think that's all like we need to know for that.
So talk a little bit more about the disconnect program. Walk me through how an individual gets involved in that.
Sure. So
you're a homeowner.
It starts by simply giving us a phone call. And we'll ask you some questions about where you live and what kind of sump pump you think you have. And, you know, and honestly, in many situations, these sump pumps have been there for some time. And homeowners may have bought a home and realize they have a sump pump but have no idea where it pumps to. So we can come out and we'll crawl in your crawl space and show you where it's connected. We have found some sump pumps connected to their backyards or to the gutter out front, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
We have inspected a couple homes where we've had 4 sump pumps at each home pumping into the wastewater system.
Oh, boy.
And that's
continuously?
Continuously. And on a daily basis, that's like 250,000 gallons a day. So significant clean water entering the system, and you know that's a real serious problem,
right?
And that has a real risk of overflowing into your home and all. So give us a call, we'll conduct inspection. Sometimes we can show you in just a matter of minutes how to correct the problem. We've had a couple people that have had garden hoses connected to the sump pumps, and all they had to do is pull it out of a little connection on the sanitary system and put it through a little vent on their house, and it goes out into a ditch in the backyard. It, you know, it can be that simple. Other situations can be a little bit more involved. But the good news is, you know, at least for a limited time, we're offering up to $1,500 as a financial incentive to work with residents to disconnect these sump pumps. And we've had a number of people take advantage of it, and we're continuing to work with homes that are have these sump pumps that takes a little bit more effort to get them disconnected. But, you know, again, do the right thing, help protect the environment, but also you can help protect your home.
So is this actually, like, you know, written into code? Is there a legal aspect of this?
Great question, Nell. Connecting a sump pump to the wastewater system is in violation of the International Plumbing Code and local codes.
Mm.
So we have contacted plumbers in the area and said, hey, you know, if you get asked to do this, you know, just keep in mind that it's against code in a number of different ways to connect sump pumps to the sanitary sewer system.
Okay.
So we've been focused on East Canyon Creek, where you said that at some point 93% of your influent into the plant was estimated to be coming from a stormwater or melt. Clean water, we'll call it. Were you seeing similar effects at the Silver Creek plant?
Yep. Great question. So the East Canyon facility collects wastewater from about 2/3 of the Park City Snidable Basin area.
Mm-hmm.
The Silver Creek plant collects a third, and you kind of think of the eastern third of Park City and Snidable Basin. And we were seeing percentages in the 75% range at Silver Creek, so still, you know, very significant. But not quite as high as East Canyon.
And do you see the same risks there as far as having high flows potentially impacting the treatment plant?
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, there's no difference. The risk of overloading the treatment plant of clean water is a real problem. But again, by not providing enough food for our bacteria and tiny critters, you can really have a serious impact on how we are able to treat the wastewater. And that's where if we were to lose our bacterial culture, we would actually start polluting the creek.
So as you see this enormous amount of water coming in, it's twice what you're designed to treat, and as that water is cleaner than you anticipate, it doesn't have enough nutrients for the microbes. Like, give us an idea of some of the things that you and your team did to keep the plants functional.
So we isolated a big, I'm going to say population, or a volume of our bacteria, and we preserved them in this tank. We would feed them only a small amount of real wastewater, as concentrated as we could find, to keep them alive so that when we saw a lesser amount of clean water coming in, then we could start operating the whole plant the way it was intended. So we have to preserve our bacteria and our tiny little critters that treat the wastewater and keep them alive. And the way we do that is we concentrate them and keep them in tanks that are not being, I'm going to say, overloaded with clean water.
Okay.
We're speaking with Mike Lures. He's general manager of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. And we're talking about this spring's runoff, snow melt, et cetera, and how it's impacted not just the treatment plants, hydraulically and biologically, as you say, Mike, but also as perhaps potentially overwhelmed the collection system itself. And the efforts you're employing to try to encourage people not to hook up their sump pump systems to wastewater collection systems, and rather have it discharge out into stormwater collection system or out on to the ground where it's possible, right? Because when you do that, you're always putting it at risk, perhaps flooding their yard or their neighbor's yard too. So there's a delicate balance in trying to identify what the right answer is here.
Yeah, certainly in most areas, there's a stormwater system underneath the street, and you have gutters out front that you can pump it to.
Okay. So, and especially, I know you're using terms, you know, bacteria and critters. They're one and the same. Let's not have these people have the image like there's actual, you know, critters they can see floating around in the water.
Yeah.
These are really small.
Yeah, think of really tiny cows, you know. Yeah. But we do have little microscopic animals.
Yes.
And they are animals, and they're different from bacteria, so we have a combination. But, we maintain the population of these things. Such, we call them like rotifers and different types of microscopic organisms that if you put them underneath a microscope, you can easily see them and you can actually watch them consume organic material on a microscope slide.
And so I'm assuming that, again, like you and your team are monitoring these on a daily basis. How frequently are you looking at
the... We monitor a daily basis.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So you peaked around East Canyon, you peaked around 10 million gallons per day a while ago. Where are you now?
As of this morning, we're in about the 3.5 range.
Okay.
3.5 million gallons a day.
So back to kind of quote-unquote normal type of operations?
We're still sitting out of that 3.5 million, we'll probably have about 1.5 million gallons of clean water entering the system today at East Canyon.
Okay. But it's much more manageable than it once was.
Right.
Okay. So the sump pump disconnect program is still ongoing.
Still ongoing.
How do people contact you?
They just call the main office at the Water Reclamation District, and it's 214-5227. Again, it's 214-5227.
Okay. And will the program continue until when?
We're going to continue until we have interest from the residents in having their pumps disconnected.
Okay. So, the best news is the fact that the runoff for both your systems, your biological hydraulic systems at Swanner, had kind of a best case scenario, experienced a best case scenario in the fact that the runoff was maybe very active during the day, but because of cool nights, slowed. And so it wasn't overwhelmed. So that's the good news. And like you say, we still have snow at, you know, above 9,000 feet in patches and areas. And but the large part, the main part of the runoff, the melt, is probably near over.
And we would
You're not losing as much sleep.
Certainly, the snow in the lower altitudes is over. And you know, we keep in mind, you know, our mountains are big sponges, and we'll see the result of this great snowpack all the way through the summertime.
All right. Last few minutes, I know you do lots of work additionally in the areas of endocrine disruptors and the presence of, we've talked in the past about pharmaceuticals and other synthetic chemical compounds that can impact those bacteria and those little critters too.
Right.
And PFASs, now we're turning our attention more and more to another set of chemicals, PFASs, and you even looked to do some work in the area of microfibers. Any updates or work that you're looking at?
Well, first of all, we anticipate the regulatory arena for PFAS to be somewhat fast-tracked for water. And I know you've talked to Michelle DeHaan with the city, and we'll see it on the wastewater side of things, too. You know, I just want to take just a minute here, though, and again, thank the Park City area for turning in their floral ski waxes to Recycle Utah and others. You know, over 220 pounds were turned in so far, and that's great because that helps protect our drinking water. And keep in mind, if it's in the drinking water, it ends up in the wastewater system, and it can impact our bacteria and our, as we said, our little critters.
Mm-hmm.
So, that you know, that's great. Thank you for all that participated in that. We continue to sample for PFAS compounds in the wastewater. There's about 12,000 PFAS different compounds.
Wow.
And the science behind PFAS and the impact of PFAS compounds on, say, our treatment plant simply has not been done yet. There's so many compounds that, you know, you can't study each individual compound. You have to do kind of a bioassay, as we call it. And those types of tests are being developed. All this is what we call relatively new science. And there's great research being done on how to remove PFAS from not only drinking water, but from wastewater. And hopefully, in not too distant future, we can come up with some ways to remove these compounds that are affordable.
Well,
is that the key piece, that are affordable, these processes?
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, we know how to do it now.
Yeah.
But when you, again, at the treatment plant, let's just say during the peak flow, we're running 10 million gallons a day. That becomes very expensive to remove these PFAS compounds because you have to get them down to very, very low levels. And we're looking for a better way to do it that can be done on site with maybe existing equipment with a little bit of upgrade. And again, we'll have to wait to see what comes out of our research laboratories.
Okay, we'll stay tuned on that.
Right. And are you still offering tours at your plant so people can visit these critters?
Oh, absolutely. If you'd like to see some of these critters
like a
under...
Zoo.
Yeah. If you'd
the
like
experience
to...
is slightly different.
Hey, if you come in and say, hey, we'd like to tour and we'd like to see these critters on a microscope slide, we'll set you up. We have a laboratory where we have a microscope and we have these TV screens that are fed off of the microscopes and we can show you these little critters. So, yes, give us a call. We do tours all the time and... We certainly welcome that.
They are fascinating, and Mike and his team will offer these to the Utah Master Naturalist and other programs, and they are always a hit. So the sewer district, always a hit.
And real quick, too, the goal is to not let these critters get out in your effluent to get in these Canyon Creek, right? You want to keep them in the plant.
Oh, no, we want to keep them because that's how we treat wastewater.
Right.
And so we separate the little critters from the treated wastewater before it goes into East Canyon Creek, as an example, and we reuse them. We recycle them, so to speak. And
they have a long, healthy life.
They have a long, happy...
Relative to what critters...
As long as they have some food to eat, we make them fat and happy.
And some oxygen, and yeah... They live the life that we only dream of.
That's correct.
Food and oxygen, and some nice water, yeah. But not too much clean water. Okay. Mike, again, the phone number to contact you, 214-5227.
That's correct.
If you're interested in the sump pump disconnect program or any other questions they might have for you.
You use that same number to arrange a tour.
All right. Perfect. Mike Lors, General Manager of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. As always, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning.
Thank you for asking us to be here.
All right. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Robert Hedges. He's the author of the new book, Wildflowers of Park City. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now in the studio for the second part of the show is Robert Hedges, the author of the new book, Wildflowers of Park City. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me here.
Well, we have a copy of this beautiful book here in the studio that we're admiring. But before we talk about the book, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into wildflowers.
Right. So I'm from Michigan, and I retired about 5 years ago. So, you know, like everybody, we came here to ski, and we stayed for the summers, right?
Yeah.
So that first spring I was here, which is 2019, I was out walking around. We have a little trail. I live off just on the other side of the Jordanelle. And I had purchased a new camera because my son got married. So I was out wandering around the trail and noticed all these wildflowers. So I decided to start taking photographs. And then pretty soon I was getting a few good photographs. So I started logging them. And I kind of thought, well, maybe I'll make a little coffee table book for myself. So I did go online and printed a little table book. But then I thought, gee, I think I need to do something a little nicer. So I went online. I found Park City Publishing. So I did this book with Lauren Nadler. And she owns Park City Publishing. Mm. And it wouldn't have happened without her. Mm-hmm. So that was way back in, you know, 2019 when we kind of started talking about this. Well, then I just put it on the shelf until last summer is when I really had enough photographs and I had done some research. And so I started putting it together last year. We ran a small test around Christmas time, just a small printing. I wanted to make sure that it had legs and made sense. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, some of the local folks like Dolly's and Park City Gardens and the market brought it in. And then that gave me the confidence to, okay, let's do a real printing, which is very recent. I just got these books the 1st of May.
Fantastic.
So that's how it all started.
Well, the photos are beautiful, and it also seems like just a fantastic tool for identification.
Yeah.
Did you have like one specific goal or another in the creation of the book? Like, was it designed for ID for the novice out there?
Yeah. So my idea was I wanted something. It's sort of all about the photographs. A lot of times when you see a field guide, the photographs are these little tiny photographs and very difficult to see. But it's also set up like a field guide. Mm-hmm. So we have the blooms, we have the trail where you can find
the habitat that it resides in.
The habitat. And then I put the longitude and latitude in there. So like if you have a LongLad app, you can put it in there, it'll take you to the trailhead.
Oh, to the trailhead, not to the plant itself.
Well, right, because, okay. You know, every year is a little different.
but yeah.
It turns out they move around at will.
But for example, I'm looking at the page that has mule's ear on it. And so it's two pages, Both pages have a photo, kind of a general shot of the plant, the flower, and then a close-up of the flower. And then, like you say, beneath it, there's information on its general habitat. In this case, mule's ear populates woodland meadows, open areas on mountain slopes, okay? The dates or the time frame in which it blooms, in this case, May to June. The trail, the specific trail that you found this plant, this particular plant on, and then the latitude and the longitude for it. So, it is a great field book in a way to bring to carry around with you. Although it's also a coffee table book, it's not like a field guide, the typical field guide that is more of a small
not meant for guide, the backpack,
but really valuable information to help.
And if you think about the number of people that are moving to Park City or have a second home in Park City, and they may not be familiar with these plants. I certainly wasn't. And there wasn't really a specific Park City guide. I mean, there are some guides. You know, Audubon has a good guide that I use. There's also a Utah guide. But again, they're field guides. And so my idea was to focus on the photography and to create something that would actually be a nice gift. So if you come to visit your friends here, this is a nice gift that you can buy. We have a lot of realtors now, right, that are using this. And it's kind of fun. We had a testimonial last week about a realtor who gave one of these at a closing. And a couple weeks later, they called her and said, "Hey, I just want to say thanks."
I love that.
So yeah, it's been a fun project.
Do you have any specific flowers that are your favorites or that you just feel like it's a gem when you get to see it?
Well, some of them are rare. So in the book, there's a purple virgin's bower. So that's similar to like a clematis or something like that. It's in that family. I've only seen it once on the Timpanogos Trail. And so I was hiking up there. I took some photos, and I was hoping that, that I would see it again to get more photos. But there's some plants like that. Bog gentian, which you see up in the Uintas. The first couple years, I didn't see a lot of them, but every year is a little different, and it just sort of depends your timing and where you're hiking, because a lot of these flowers will only bloom for a couple weeks, and then they're gone.
Yeah.
So, by the way, we're speaking with Robert Hedges. He's the author of the new book, Wildflowers of Park City. And, of course, the book is available for sale right now. Yes. Is there a website?
There is, wildflowersofparkcity.com.
Oh, thank you.
And
it's
a simple website.
Yes.
You can contact me, like if you have a question. I had someone send me an email yesterday asking where it's available. The book is also on Maiden Park City. That's a website that if somebody's listening from afar, they could go on that website and order one. And then the other part of the book, I have sections called plant lore, which as I started to research these flowers, there was all these fun stories about these biologists back in the 1800s, or like, for example, there's one on Lewis monkey flowers. Well, Lewis monkey flowers, you can find those up on the Lake Mary Trail at Brighton. I've seen them up at Albion Basin, but it's named for Lewis Merriweather. So there's all these little stories about how these flowers got their name, or the fact that a lot of these bulbs are edible, like the sago lily, for example, which is the state flower. When the pioneers first came to Utah, they learned from the Native Americans that you could eat the sago lily bulbs. It was really important to those pioneers because they survived those first few winters partially by eating those bulbs. And that is one of the reasons why it's our state flower.
It's fascinating. What are the other reasons why it's our state flower? And actually, would you give a little description of the flower itself, the best you can without a visual?
Yeah, it's a lily. So it's a white flower, but it's very intricate on the interior. It's got red and a lot of different colors. We see it up around the Jordanelle a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's just a really beautiful flower.
Oh, yeah. So how many wildflowers have you spotted, identified, and are there still some that you're still looking for?
Well, no doubt. There are so many wildflowers. So okay. I basically had categorized like 100. In this book are 81. So I tried to pick some of the more interesting looking flowers. Some are a little more rare than others. But like right now, we're having this incredible spring because we had such an incredible winter. So as you drive down the valley, heading to Salt Lake, or if you're driving from Park City to Heber, you see all these yellow flowers blooming all over the side of the hill. So those are arrowleaf balsam root. And that's, you know, I think we could have an arrowleaf balsam root festival here
yes.
in Park
really?
City.
Yes.
Even behind us, as we're sitting here up on Masonic Trail, that's one of the trails I feature in the book. It dries out early, so if you take a walk up there today, you'll see all the arrowleaf balsam root. But then there's all kinds of other things going on. Yesterday, I took a little walk up by my house, and I hadn't been up there for a while because I had been out of town for 10 days. And so early on, you know, these little forget-me-nots and Nuttall's larkspur were up there. So last night, knowing I was coming in here, I thought, well, I better go walk up there and see what else is blooming. And I was shocked at the quantity. There's a sweet pea, a step sweet pea, and it was, I just couldn't believe the quantity. I mean, I've been hiking around here now for 5 summers, so it's going to be spectacular. I mean, a lot of these trails, like Rob's trail, are probably still wet, and you know, we don't really want to hike those wet trails, you know, in the mud. But as they dry out, it's going to be a spectacular year for wildflowers.
Absolutely. So, it's already off to a fantastic start, as you mentioned.
Right. And now, what are you seeing? Proliferations of wildflowers on the preserve that maybe you haven't seen in past years too?
We are.
In type and number?
We are. I've noticed a little bit more diversity. I've noticed some flowers that I haven't noticed in the past in certain places. The timing has been a little bit later, but not as much later as we might have anticipated given all of the snow. But we're just very excited to see kind of how the bloom continues. It really is an amazing array out there right now. Like this week has just been incredible.
Really?
As you noticed upon return from your trip.
It's amazing. And I think it'll be that way all summer because you mm-hmm. do have some wildflowers that traditionally bloom late summer. But with all this moisture, it's just going to be a big year. So in the book, I highlight 8 hiking trails right. that I felt were really good wildflower trails. And some of them are on the other side of the Wasatch, like Lake Mary at Brighton or Secret Lake at the Albion Basin. Lake Blanche is a great one. And then on this side, you know, Silver Lake Trail up at Deer Valley is a mm-hmm. great place to hike. The Timpanogos Trail, Robb's Trail, of course, everybody seems to know that trail. And then over by the Jordanelle on the Perimeter Trail. I was over at Rock Cliff yesterday, and there's a flower called Mountain Golden Pea. So they're yellow, but there were fields of them. And I got out of the car to go look at it to make sure it was what I thought it was. And then I also noticed there's another one called Starry Falls Solomon Seal. And it was blooming like crazy down there. And I had never noticed those in previous years. So it's going to be a good year.
It's a fun year. So I have to ask, you know, you've spent a couple of years really so focused on this. You mentioned your recent retirement. Did you have a career that related to biology or plants in any way, or is this a new interest?
The answer is no. I was in the food business, but sales and marketing.
Okay, all right.
Okay, so my father was a biologist.
Oh, okay.
So my dad was working on his PhD when his GI Bill ran out, and he had two kids. So he took a job with the Upjohn Company in pharmaceuticals, and he did that his whole life. But I grew up with a father who would point out plants and animals and take me fly fishing. And
yeah.
And then on the other side of it, my grandfather was a professional photographer.
Oh, wow.
So I guess that's it.
Yeah. It comes through your genes.
That wonderful synergy of those two things. So in the last couple minutes, like you say, there's still more wildflowers. Are most of these native species? Nell, you can help jump in. Or are some of these non-native, or they're not invasive, let's say, per se? Maybe they are.
No, they're all native. I'll give you an example. So there's a flower, a toad flax. It almost looks like a snapdragon. And when I found out it was invasive, I decided not to put it in the book. Mm. But, you know, some of these plants, well, you know, a lot of these plants are edible, but some of them are poisonous.
Right.
So there's this plant called death camas.
Oh, Cheryl Fox was just saying, someone later said she was out looking for that.
Right.
Is that it?
It's
here?
Flowering right now.
Is it?
Well,
okay.
It is. I saw it yesterday. And so, that's in the book. And then there's monk's hood, which is a purple flower that blooms later in the year. You don't want to eat that one either. And then even Nuttall's larkspur. So the Indians used to use the dye from that. It was a blue dye, and they put it on their arrows. But parts of that plant are also toxic. So, but a lot of these plants are edible as well.
I was just trying to find Silver Lake Trail, that area in Deer Valley. I think there are some trails out there that are hiking only, which is always my preferred trail to walk on, particularly if I'm out exploring.
Yes.
And focusing, you know, you want to be, don't want to get run over by a bike or
exactly.
So.
Exactly.
So I think Silver Lake Trail might be hiking only. There's
it
several
is.
Others. Okay. So that's a really nice trail to go and explore and just kind of just be engaged and engrossed in all the wildlife out there. And speaking of which, you know, you're talking about what a prolific year this could be with respect to wildflowers. And then there's the knock-on effects, Nell, I guess about it could be a tremendous year for our lepidopterist folks. Butterflies and moths and native bees and stuff will all benefit. So we may see some really unusual sightings in those areas too.
Exactly. It's going to be an exciting summer.
Well, this book is such a fun way to start to explore and learn about our wildflowers specific to the Park City area, with beautiful photos and great information.
Yeah. Bob Hedges, thank you again for taking the time to stop by. And again, like you say, it's locally published too, Park City Publishing. And while I got a shout out to my friend Melissa Marstead, who actually emailed me your book and said, hey, this might be a nice guest. And
well,
sure enough, it
much.
Was. Yes. So, Bob, thanks again for joining us
thank
this
you.
Morning on This Green Earth.